And 40. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Lynn L. from San Carlos.
My name is Lynn, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I'm really, really excited to be here, and I want to thank Jeff for asking me. I have spoken at this meeting once before. It was in 1999, and a lot has happened since then, and I'm excited to be here, and I hope that something that I say tonight will help somebody. First of all, I want to kind of give you a little idea about where I'm at today, because a lot of times after I start talking, it's like I go in this other place and it's difficult to get out of it. And I think it's really important to share some of the things. I listened to Betsy get up here after she got her cake, and she has 32 years. And you know, I felt what she was saying, kind of. Here's what I think. I think it's really hard to stay sober. I really do. And I think sobriety is not any kind of a cakewalk. I think it's, for a person like me, it's been incredibly difficult. And, you know, I was the kind of person who always drank. When I felt anything, I drank. When I felt bad, I drank. When I felt afraid, I drank. When I felt good, I drank. No matter what I felt, I always drank. And so to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and to not drink, it's been tough. It's required an awful lot of courage, I think. And I think it requires courage for anybody to stay here and not drink if you come from where I came from. I got to say this. I love being an alcoholic. It's the best thing that ever actually happened to me. I've been sober for, I had 30 years in December. And I got sober when I was 29 years old. And actually, I got to tell you, my 29th sober birthday was really a big deal for me, because it was like I lived till I was 29 in hell. I literally lived in hell. And then I lived 29 years with you guys. And it's like you gave me a whole new lifetime. You allowed me to have a whole new lifetime. And now I'm in the best part of all. It's like I got this bonus plan going now, and I'm really excited about it. I've never been happier in my whole life than I am today. But I got to tell you, I've gone through a lot of changes. That 29th year brought on a lot of things for me. You know, when I came to AA, I was like most young women who come here. I was 29 years old. I had two kids. I had been a single mom for about 6 years, supporting my kids as best I could, drinking myself into an early grave. And I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, of course, the first thing I did when I got here and began to sober up is I wanted to find him. I wanted to find Mr. Right somehow, you know? And, you know, when I first came to AA, I didn't want him to be in AA. I wanted him to be elsewhere. This was okay for me, but, you know, I didn't really want to meet one of you here. And so I looked elsewhere. But, you know, what happened to me right in my first year of sobriety is you guys hooked me. I got caught up on this way of life. This is the way of life I was always looking for. You are the people that I was always looking for. And so, you know, my first year I went out a few times with some guys that weren't in AA, and it was a little bit difficult. I mean, I'd tell them my story, and at the end of that, there was not much left to say, actually. I mean, they didn't have anything that compared to my story, and they were like left with their mouth hanging open, and I was bored with them. So, and on a more serious note is, you know, something happened to me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got introduced to a higher power, and I got introduced to a way of spiritual living that I really believe I'd always been searching for, and it is the most important thing in my life. And I live every day with a consciousness of the fact that, number one, my life is a miracle, and every single day that I have is just a bonus for somebody like me. And number two is that God has given me this wonderful life. You taught me how to live. And so when I started thinking about who my soulmate would be, who he would be, it became clear to me he would have to feel that same way, that it's so important to me that I would want to be sharing that. And lo and behold, when I was sober about 5 years, I met my soulmate in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, we got married, and I'm telling you, we had the best. We went to meetings everywhere. We had the AA life. You know, we did service together. We went to meetings together. We went to meetings separately. We traveled all over the world. We went to meetings in Mexico, and somebody said Singapore tonight. And we went to all of those places, and we danced, and we laughed, and we had the grandest time. And we were both sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. But for whatever reason, it's a mystery to me. I don't know why we drink again. But for whatever reason, my husband, after 20 years of being here, decided that alcohol would solve a problem for him, and he picked up the drink. And I'm not here to talk about his part of that story, but I'm here to tell you about my part of it, because you know, when I got married in Alcoholics Anonymous, I really wanted to do the grown-up thing. I wanted to do the till death do us part. I really wanted to have a lifetime commitment with a person. I wanted to experience what that was going to be like. I wanted to do for richer or poorer. And we did for richer or poorer. And I wanted to do in sickness and in health. And we did that too. But you know, the disease of alcoholism is a deal breaker, I think, for most alcoholics, particularly if one wants to stay sober and the other doesn't. You know, I was in New York City in 1997. I was on a business trip when I called home and heard that my husband was drinking. And I'm telling you, you could have knocked me over with a cannon, because it was like my whole life was pulled out from under me. And, you know, I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk about what happened to me, because the experience became one that I had to live with. I had to make that choice about in sickness and in health. And I tried to do in sickness for 5 years. I tried to stay with it in the hopes that it would change, that we would go back to what it was. But after 5 years, we were talking at dinner, by the way, about Al-Anon. I'll tell you, you know, I went to Al-Anon a lot of times since I've been sober. I went to Al-Anon because one kid was drunk, or some friend was drinking, or, you know, whatever the situation was. I went to Al-Anon, and then I went to ACA, and I've been to all the programs that, you know, seemed to apply to me. But I never really understood Al-Anon until 1997, when I went there on my knees. And it was a different situation. And I'm telling you that Al-Anon saved my ass. And finally, in the end, I knew that I had to leave. And so 2 years ago, right before my 29th birthday in AA, I became a single woman again. And, you know, it's a funny thing, because I want to just tell you one story out of the whole incident, and I hope it means something to somebody. You know, after living for 5 years with all the uncertainty and the fear and all the agony of living with a practicing alcoholic like myself, I developed a lot of compassion, particularly for myself and also for other people who lived with me during the time I was drinking. But anyway, after 5 years when I left, I have to tell you, there were no more tears left. When I left, it was let me out. It was get me out of here, get me a place, I gotta be gone. I cannot live with it anymore. I feared for my own sobriety and certainly my own sanity. And my own sobriety is the most precious thing I have. And so when I got out, I didn't cry. I was happy. I was happy to be moving out. I was happy to get a new place. I was happy to be back going to meetings all the time by myself. I was happy with everything that was happening. Until about 2 months after I left, I had to go back to Maui, where we owned a second home. And I had to go sell it. And it was the home that I dreamt of living in until death do us part. It was the home where we were going to share our life, until we both, you know, had no more life left. And I was the one, of course, because when the one person's drinking, the other one's the only one that gets things done, and I was the one that had to go sell it. And I didn't cry for 2 months, and I got over to Maui, I got off the plane, and I got hysterical. I got off the plane, I could hardly contain myself as I was walking off the jet ramp. It was just so much pain. I was just in agony, and I went and got my rental car, and I picked up my cell phone, and I called him, and I started screaming at him, you did that, da, 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 you did that. I only got his message phone, though. It was just a message. You ruined my life and all of our dreams, and on and on and on and on. And then I hung up. And I drove across the island and started to do what I had to do. And about an hour later, I got a phone call from him. He says, "Are you all right?" And I said, "No, I'm not." And I started screaming and crying out of him again. And at the end of that second conversation, when I was talking with him, I said, "But you know what? I'm going to be all right after I go to 5:30 happy hour meeting in Kalama Park. I'll be fine." And you know what he said? He said, "You know, that's the difference between you and me. Because you will go to that meeting and you'll be fine, and I would go to the bar and drink." And you know, when he said that, it just was like, of course, that's the difference. And I don't really understand it. I don't understand why I would go to the park and go to the meeting, and I don't understand why another alcoholic would go to the bar and drink. But anyway, I wanted to just share that because, you know, one thing I have learned is that I can live through almost anything. Anything is, for 30 years now, I've lived through a lot of painful things, and I haven't had to pick up a drink of alcohol. And that's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And I go to a really powerful women's meeting on Friday evenings. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about staying in the middle of the herd. You know, it's the ones on the outside that get picked off. And if you see the animals in Africa and you see those jungle programs and stuff, you always see it's the one that can't keep up or the one who's on the outskirts that gets picked off by the lion or whatever the predator is. And I think it's the same way in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know for me, I don't have any answers, actually. I don't really know completely how this thing works. I just know that I want to stay sober, and I will do anything to stay sober. And if that means being in the center of the herd, then that's where I'm going to get myself, because I don't want to drink again. For me, the life of drinking was living in hell every single moment, and I don't want to go back. You know, I grew up with alcoholism, and so for me, I didn't know any other kind of life except the life of alcoholism, the life of our disease. And I have this to say, if you grew up with alcoholism and then you became an alcoholic like I did, then you really don't have a clue about life. You don't know anything. You only know a disease. You lived in a disease. I lived in a disease from the day I came to this earth. I lived in the disease of alcoholism. I thought that was normal. What else could I think? I didn't know anything else. And, you know, when Betsy was talking, it was once again, she was saying about, you know, things happen slowly here. This is not, for me anyway, it wasn't a process of, oh, I got here and then I was sober and then life got good. It wasn't like that at all. You know, I lived 29 years in sickness, and so it took a long time, a lot of processes to begin to heal some of the things I thought were normal things. But these are the things I've learned in AA. And I thought when I came here, and maybe some of you new people are thinking this too, I thought if I ever got 30 days, I'd be as sober as normal people are. I thought I'd have it made. Well, actually, that's a lie. I thought if I ever got like 48 hours, I'd be cold, stone sober. You know, that'd be sobriety. I just had no conception of any other kind of life except what I knew. And what I knew was not very happy, and that's why I probably didn't want to stay sober very long. Because if I was sober more than 48 hours, things got pretty messed up quickly in my mind and in my life. And then I'd go back to drinking. Anyway, so I grew up in this alcoholic family. I actually grew up across the bay in Walnut Creek. And my dad was the alcoholic and my mom was an untreated Al-Anon. And I was afraid. That's all I can tell you. If I have any feelings that I can remember from my childhood, I was afraid. And I think fear was the only thing I felt from early, early on. It took me a long time to understand this in AA, but I realized after years of therapy and years of programs, different programs, and ACA, and all this kind of thing, to realize that I never had any other feelings except fear. Fear was what dominated my life. And so when my father went to prison when I was 11, I was even more afraid. We ended up moving back to Salt Lake City where my mother's mother was. And I just was so afraid. I mean, I all of a sudden was in an environment where I didn't fit in at all. And I tried for a couple of years to sort of make my way along. And then I got a new group of friends. And I don't remember if it was necessarily the first time I drank, but I do remember this. It was the first time I ever got the feeling from alcohol. You know that feeling that kind of goes down the center of you? That feeling that makes everything a little bit better inside of you. For me, it was a feeling that let me, for once, start to breathe. The fear eased up for me. And all of a sudden, I thought that maybe I could be like other people. And I loved that feeling. I loved that feeling I got from alcohol. And from that time on, my life changed drastically. Once I found out what that drug would do for me, I just wanted to feel that way all the time. And so I was maybe 13 or 14 years old, and I found out that I could transform my whole world by drinking alcohol. And I loved it. And actually, I did transform my whole world. I went from being a straight-A student to not even going to school. I went from running around with a bunch of kind of goody-two-shoe kind of people to running around with people who didn't care about school. They cared about partying and drinking and smoking and all that kind of stuff. And that's all I cared about, too, from then on. And by the time I was 16 or 17 years old, I was probably a full-blown alcoholic by what we know today about alcoholism. I remember when I was 16, I lost my boyfriend's car in a blackout. And I didn't know what blackouts were. I didn't know any of that stuff. I just never forgot that night, because when I came to the next morning, I was in some strange place with some people I wasn't sure who they were. But worst thing was, I'd lost my boyfriend's car. And he was nowhere around, and I wasn't with him. I was with, like, other than him. And so it was a really kind of difficult situation. And, you know, and so when I came to AA and I heard people talk about losing their car, I thought, God, I lost my first car when I was 16. And I got married when I was 17. I sort of was getting afraid. By the time I was 17, I was getting really afraid of where my life was going. Because like many people, I think I grew up with an idea about what a happy life is going to be. I had an idea, and I think it probably came in my generation from Ozzie and Harriet. You know, a happy life was where you got married to a nice guy. You didn't have to be a millionaire. I mean, I didn't have, like, fancy dreams. I had, like, normal dreams. You know, I wanted to marry a nice, clean guy who'd go to work every day, put me in a house with that little white picket fence, had a couple of kids, and go to the PTA. That's kind of what I thought a happy life was. Well, by the time I was 16, I was running around with the president of the local Hell's Angels chapter, and most of the people I was running around with, you know, I didn't belong with those people at all. Most of them were like in their 20s and 30s, and they were into a lot of heavy-duty stuff. I was 16 years old. I was a little kid. But, you know, those people always had drugs and alcohol, so I always felt like I belonged with them, because I could always be drinking or using something to feel like I was accepted. And so, but I was getting scared. It was clear to me that this guy I was sitting behind on the Harley wasn't going to be white picket fence material. And so I was working. I had my first career job at the time. I was working at the A&W. I was a car hop. I actually started working there when I was 14 because my mom had nothing. I mean, my dad was in jail. I was the oldest of three kids. And so I had to get a job just so I could buy my cigarettes, because nobody was buying any smokes for me. And so that's the main reason I went to work at the age of 14, was to buy cigarettes. And so I kept the job for 3 or 4 years. And I was working at the A&W one day, and this guy started coming in there, and he was like the opposite of my boyfriend. He had really short hair. He was really clean looking. He had like a button-down collar and one of those little crew neck sweater type things, and he drove a Corvair. And this was not the kind of guy I'd typically like chase after, okay? He didn't look like very dangerous, and I always liked the dangerous type. But, you know, he kept coming in there, and what he began to look like to me was a white picket fence. And, you know, I always believe now that God answers all prayers, and I think possibly he was the answer to my mother's prayers at the time, because her oldest child was in a lot of serious trouble, and so here comes this guy in the Corvair. And you know what he looked like to me? He looked like a white picket fence. He looked like a ticket out of where I was living, a path I was going down, which was really scaring me, let alone scaring everybody else. And so I married the guy. I was 17 years old when I married him, and ironically, he didn't drink. So I married a guy who didn't drink, and we moved back to California. And what it was like for me, what it felt like for me is like I was the girl from the other side of the tracks, the bad side of the tracks, okay? And I was marrying up in life. his family came from this insurance money, and, you know, I thought they were like, I thought they knew everything about everything, and all I wanted to do was to be somebody else. And so I thought when I married him, I'd become Mrs. Somebody Else. And so I married the guy, and the very first, before we even got married, we had an incident that should have told everybody there was going to be big problems. But what happened was that we came out here, and it was New Year's Eve before we got married, I think in March, and I came out here to meet my in-laws. Now, I really wanted to fit in with these people. I wanted them to really, like, take me into their family. They were like the family I wanted to belong to. I didn't want to be in my family. I wanted to be in this sort of upper middle class kind of place. And so I really wanted them to just like me. But it was New Year's Eve, and we got invited to a party that my fiance's father's friends were having, his business associates. And it was in Daly City, and they invited us to go. So we go to the party, and the first thing that happened in the party is somebody put a glass in my hand, and I started drinking. And, you know, I have to tell you, up until this time, I thought I was pretty hot. But the truth is, I don't think I drank much more than beer, cherry, slow gin. And now all of a sudden I'm at this New Year's Eve party with a glass of something good. I don't know what it was, but I liked it. Some kind of whiskey was in that glass, and I liked it. And about 10 o'clock at night, I was really drunk. And I was dancing with all my future father-in-law's business associates and making a general ass of myself, kissing them and throwing myself on them and all kinds of things. And then the woman who was giving the party thought I was getting a little out of hand, and so she asked me if I wanted a cup of coffee or something, and I told her to get fucked and leave me alone. And this is my first introduction to my in-laws, and I want them to really, like, embrace me and welcome me into the family. My fiancé took me out and had to get me out of there because I was just a mess. I was drunk, drunk, drunk. And the next morning we were staying at their place. The next morning I get up, I'm sick. I feel horrible. My fiance told me a couple of things I did. And I got to sit at the back breakfast table with these people. I was just humiliated. I wanted them to embrace me, and I just made a total fool of myself. Anyway, we were married for 7.5 years. And during the 7.5 years we were married, we hardly ever drank. We had no money. We were really poor. And yet, every time we drank, it seemed that we were always with his parents. And it was always a disaster. There was a night about 2 years later at the Richelieu Hotel on Van Ness Avenue. There was a big party his company was having, and he said to me, "Don't mix your drinks. Just stick to one thing, and you'll probably be all right tonight." So I tried to, but they ran out of whatever I was drinking. Now, I don't know if it's because I was drinking so much or what, but about 10 o'clock there was no more of whatever I had, and so I had to switch, because I was the kind of person, when I look back honestly on my life, I don't think that I ever said no to a glass of alcohol. The only way I ever quit drinking was either I passed out, somebody took me home, or they ran out of booze. It was one of those three things, because as long as the booze was flowing and I was on my feet, I drank. That's the way it was. Anyway, I married for 7.5 years. We had 2 kids. It wasn't that bad of a marriage, but he was a chronic gambler. Even though he didn't drink, he had his problems. And after 7.5 years, I decided to get a divorce. Now, part of my thing when I got the divorce is I felt like I'd really missed out on, you know, my youth. I'd missed out on all the parties the rest of you were out having. So when I got divorced at 25, I started drinking every day. Now, I didn't start drinking because I was sad or scared about being divorced. I started drinking because I felt like I was owed a party, that it was time for me to cut loose and have some good times. Now, I was 25 years old. I was a single mother with 2 children, living on welfare, and I had no education. And so I was kind of in a really tight spot. And on one side, I really wanted to, you know, get out and have a good time, and I wanted to make something of myself. On the other side, I was terrified. And so I'd lay in bed at night and not be able to sleep. So I went and saw my doctor. And the first thing he did is he gave me some sleeping pills. And so this all happened like in July of 1969 when I'm getting divorced. I started drinking every day and I started using sleeping pills every day. And, you know, it didn't start out bad. You know, it started out kind of calm. It started out where, you know, if I took a sleeping pill with a 12-ounce glass of wine, I could go to sleep. And I slept the night, and I could get up in the morning, and I could feel okay and get on with my life. And, you know, it felt okay at first. It felt like maybe booze and the sleeping pill were fixing me. You know, I think that's kind of the case with all alcoholics, is that alcohol starts fixing us. And as soon as it starts fixing us, it becomes the problem. And that's what happened with me. And I figured at this time, if I could get a good job, that everything would be okay. So lo and behold, I went out and I got a great job. This job I got was in sales for a national corporation. It was a chance of a lifetime for a girl who didn't even have a high school degree. And I'd never even actually been in an office before. And now I had this sales job, and I went into this office in Burlingame, up on the strip, and I really wanted to do well at this job. I knew this was probably the only chance I was going to get. And so I got into this office, and I learned about some new things. The first thing I learned about is that these people would go out to lunch at these fancy restaurants like Charlie Brown's or Tia Maria's, and they would have like martinis for lunch. Oh my God, I thought this was the most sophisticated thing I'd ever heard of. I thought that I was like in a Betty Davis movie. And here I was with my martini glass and my cigarette. I mean, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. This was the life I'd been looking for. And yet almost immediately I found out that if I had the martini at lunch, I didn't go back to work. Something would happen. You know, there'd be all these reasons to have a second one and have a third one and have a fourth one. And we'll order lunch later. The kitchen's busy right now. Let's have another drink. And there was one rationalization after another. And so I stopped drinking at lunchtime because I needed that job. So I must have still had some control. I stopped drinking at lunchtime. But I learned about something else when I got the job. I learned that there was something called happy hour. I must not have been very sophisticated because I didn't know about any of this stuff. And when they told me that you could go to a place like Charlie Brown's and get drinks 2 for 1, I thought, oh my God, this is wonderful. And so I worked in an office with all men, which I love too, of course. And so about 3 in the afternoon, I'd just find any willing guy to head over to happy hour, and I'd start drinking. And, you know, I'd call the babysitter and tell her I'd be late, and I'd call her again and tell her to feed the kids, and then I'd call her again and tell her to put the kids to bed. I was stuck in a business meeting, right? I was stuck in Charlie Brown's with a glass in my hand. And by the time I'd get home night after night, it'd be 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and, you know, maybe I'd bring somebody home with me, maybe not. It was always kind of questionable what would happen once I started drinking. And my life was starting to get out of control. It was really spinning out of control quickly. And so the job started doing better. I started making more money. I started having a little credibility. And somehow I was still able to hold it together. But I was dying inside. I was literally dying. I had that hole of the alcoholic inside of me. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong. I was making more money. I had men in my life. I had all the things I thought were going to make me happy, and I wasn't happy at all. And so I decided I better see a shrink. So I started seeing a psychiatrist. And the first thing the psychiatrist did was prescribe tranquilizers for me, very first time in there. And so now I'm taking Seconals, I'm taking Valiums, and I'm drinking alcohol. And I'm being treated for depression. Now, look at it. Seconals are a depressant. Valium is a depressant. Booze is a depressant. Of course I was depressed. I mean, who wouldn't be depressed? I think if you took a normal person and put all those chemicals in them, they'd be pretty depressed. But I'm being treated for depression, okay? So I started seeing the shrink. I was the first person in my family to ever see a shrink, so I was really embarrassed about that. And I took all the drugs, and nothing got better, and I kept on drinking. And about 6 or 8 weeks after I started seeing him, I decided he wasn't helping me. And so I decided to take a bottle of sleeping pills. And I don't know if I wanted to end my life, but what I did want is I wanted some help. I knew I was going downhill. I knew I was spinning out of control. And so I took this bottle of sleeping pills. Actually, I was living down in Santa Clara at the time. I was beginning those little moves, you know, those geographic things alcoholics make. And I ended up at Kaiser in Santa Clara having my stomach pumped and going through the emergency room and all this kind of stuff. And the end result of that evening was that I ended up in a wheelchair being pushed through a white tunnel into some psychiatric hospital. And the only thing I could be conscious of is when I got there, the first thing they did is they put a menu in my hand and they told me I had to order my food for the next day. And so I said, okay, and I'm looking at the menu and I'm checking off what I want for breakfast and lunch. And lo and behold, I could order red or white wine with my dinner. And I thought, well, this isn't going to be too bad. So I ordered a glass of red wine with my dinner. And I tell you that I wasn't in that nut house more than about 3 days when I learned the ropes. Alcoholics learn the ropes quickly. This was in 1970. In 1970, alcoholics were not in, they didn't have like 28-day treatment programs. Insurance wouldn't recognize alcoholism as a disease. And so you ended up in the nut house. And in the nut house, there was a population that was about 50-50. 50% of the people were nuts and 50% were alcoholics. And the thing that you learned if you were an alcoholic is you learned right away that the people who were nuts didn't care about having wine with their dinner. And so if you had two or three friends that were nuts, you could have like four glasses of wine with dinner. And I'm telling you, we all, the alcoholics that were in the ward, we all learned that right away. That was the thing you learned. And so I would have two glasses of red and two glasses of white with my dinner. And people who were nuts didn't care. They'd let you have all their wine. Anyway, what I noticed, though, is that was really not enough for me by that time because I was really getting pretty toxic with alcohol. And so I was sitting in the day room one day, and there was a guy in the day room, and he got all upset. We were having lunch on our little trays and stuff, and he took his lunch tray, and he threw it across the room. And everybody got all upset. The nurses were running around, and they were crazy, and they come out there, and they had this needle, and they stuck the needle in his arm, and the guy got really mellow. And I noticed. Now, I didn't get it immediately, okay? I might have been a little slow, but this guy was good. The very next day, he got some newspapers, and he lit a fire in the day room this time. He was kind of under a table over on the side, and the fire engines come, and everybody's crazy, and, you know, the nuts are going to get out, and the nurses are running around. But all I noticed was that needle came out again. And I saw he got really mellow again. And I knew whatever he was getting is what I needed. And so I, you know, I could throw my dinner tray. I could do that kind of stuff. I could do a lot of stuff to get what I needed. I was already full-blown addicted. And so I began doing a lot of behaviors. I didn't do his exact behaviors, but I did a lot of other behaviors so that I could get better drugs. And I don't think it's necessarily unusual for a person like me because I needed to have something between me and a life I couldn't live and a person that I couldn't live with, which was me. Anyway, that was 1970. I had two more suicide attempts right away. You see, as soon as I got out of the nut house, by the way, we never talked about alcohol or drugs in the nut house. That was like not the subject you ever talked about. You talked about your mother, your father, your last lover, you know, why you couldn't keep a relationship, boo-hoo, your children, all that stuff, but you never talked about your drinking or drugs. And so when I got out, the first thing I always did was I had a drink. First thing, I mean, I'd get out and I'd say, let's go have a drink. And I'd have a drink. And then, you know, I'd be in worse shape in 2 or 3 weeks. Anyway, the third time after my third suicide attempt, it was 1971, and I was back locked up again. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 27 years old. I'd had three suicide attempts. I'd been locked up for several months off and on in nut houses. My life was completely unmanageable, and I went to an AA meeting. I walked into the room, and the first thing I noticed was how old everybody was. I did not want to be in AA. I certainly did not want to be an alcoholic. I wanted to have, you know what I wanted to have? I wanted to have exotic psychiatric problems, sort of sophisticated kind of, you know, issues. And mostly I wanted to just have something where I could get a pill and then I could go sit on the bar stool with my friends and Charlie Brown. That's what I wanted. And so I obviously didn't want to be an AA, but I think God works in strange and mysterious ways. Because I went to an AA meeting in 1971. I learned there was a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think the thing that probably was the most difficult for me to learn about AA was that you didn't drink. I couldn't conceive of a life without drinking. It was beyond my comprehension that I could live a life without drinking. And so the fact that you didn't drink in AA was, I think it probably terrified me, but it certainly wasn't something I wanted. And so I didn't stay in AA. And I got out of the hospital that time taking Anabuse. And a few weeks later, taking Anabuse, I got drunk again. And anyway, you know, our big book says that alcoholism is a disease. It's a progressive and terminal disease. I tried AA the first time when I was 27, and I continued to drink for 2 more years. I'd already had 3 suicide attempts. I'd had lockups. I'd had all the humiliation that alcohol could deliver. But I wasn't ready. And so there was nowhere to go but down. And so the next 2 years were only worse. I had like 8 suicide attempts. I was in and out of psychiatric hospitals all over the peninsula. I didn't drink very much during the next 2 years because I really became really toxic with alcohol. You know, I'd pick up, you know, I'd go for spells of time. I drank twice taking Anabuse. Now, if anybody's ever drank once taking Anabuse, there's really something wrong with you if you ever drink twice taking Anabuse. I mean, you drink once taking Anabuse, you believe life has just ended as you know it. And, you know, I can't imagine how a person could drink a second time. But I was so mentally screwed up, I would just think, who are they to tell me I can't drink? Of course I can drink. And then I'd pick up the drink. Of course, they weren't taking Anabuse. I was taking Anabuse. Anyway, during those 2 years, I attempted suicide 8 times. I had shock treatments. I had straitjackets. I was in and out of nut houses. My life was completely out of control. And I lived in hell every single day. And yet, there were days when I would pick myself up and go back to work. You know, I'd dry out, go through DTs. Normally, the way that my drinking got is that I'd start drinking and then I'd be laying on the floor drunk in my apartment. My kids would have to get an ambulance or something to take me somewhere to get me to sober up. And then I'd go back and I wouldn't drink for a while and then I'd pick up the drink again. That's where I was in the November of 1973. And I'd been drinking again. And I decided that I had to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. There was no way out for me. And that's where I was about September. I started thinking about it. And around November, I started drinking again. And I ended up back in the hospital. I ended up in Sequoia Hospital. And I came in the middle of the night in a blackout in an ambulance. And somehow they ended up taking me over to the psychiatric unit. Now, at this time, I could no longer really get admitted to the psychiatric unit because no doctor on staff would put their name on my chart. So I'd sort of blackmailed my way into the psychiatric unit. They had to hold me for a few hours because I was insane and probably going to kill myself or somebody else. And so I got into the psychiatric unit. And I just want to tell you this one last story about my drinking because I think every woman that's here will identify, maybe every guy too. But as sick as I was, and all these things I was going through, and all the trouble that was in my life, I always knew the biggest problem I had was that I'd just been unlucky in love. And if I would just meet the right guy, I would get this all straightened out. I mean, if that guy would show up that would put me in that little house, I was thinking about that white picket fence thing, you know, with the apron and the peanut butter cookies and the PTA and the Sunday school. If he would just show up, this would all be fine. It would go away and I wouldn't be crazy like this anymore. So I'm sitting locked up in the psychiatric unit on the next morning. We're sitting in group in the circle and I looked across the group and there he was. Now all I heard was that he said he was a an engineer from Lockheed. And that was good enough for me. Now, the fact he was locked up in the same nut house I was in just didn't occur to me that, you know, he wasn't going to, like, put me in a white picket fence. And so I got out, and then he got out on a pass. He wasn't near as bad as I was. They threw me out. He got out on a pass. And I have to tell you that I don't think we ever had sex. We were too sick. We were alcoholics. We were attracted to each other because we both were in love with a bottle of booze. And we started drinking together. And you know, when I came to AA and they say you sink to your own, that lower level of companionship, I was with a person who was as sick as I was. And all we did was drink for the next 3 or 4 weeks. The end result was a day in December that we were both in my apartment in Belmont, and he decided to kill himself. And he got a razor blade out, and he was going to slash his wrist. And it was one of the big, typical alcoholic dramas, you know. And, you know, I have a lot of things that I'm really grateful for. But, you know, that day, my children were in school. And, you know, if that day had unfolded the way I had it planned, the way he had it planned, my children would have come home from school that day and found their mother and some strange man in pools of blood in the living room. But what happened was something else. Somehow in the middle of that drama, an ambulance came and got him and took him away. I had told him when he got the razor blade out to do my wrist first because I wanted to be dead more than anything. I wanted to be dead. My life was not worth living. The only two things I cared about in the world were my children, and I was destroying them, and I knew it. It was obvious to me and everyone else. And so death to me was the only way to get out of where I was. But that ambulance came and took him away that day and left me alone. And when I came to that afternoon, I was standing in my kitchen with a phone in my hand, and I was talking to a woman from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have no idea why or how that phone call was made. All I know is that I was talking to this woman, and she was asking me if, I don't know what she was asking me. I mean, I was really, really drunk. I was as drunk as a person can be. But she said somebody was going to call me back, and another woman called me back. And this other woman that called me back asked me if I'd like to go to an AA meeting that night. And you know, I often think about the bonds we develop here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know sometimes we try so hard to help the newcomer. But you know, when I think back about my own story, what was important to me were three things she told me. The first one was she was a woman about my age and a single mother. That's all I got. She was about my age and she had a kid. The second thing that she told me was she lived around the corner from me. Now that was really a big deal because I didn't know there were any alcoholics in my neighborhood. I don't know what I thought, but anyway, the third thing she told me was she was an alcoholic and she didn't drink anymore because she went to AA, and that she would take me to a meeting that night if I wanted to go. And I went to a meeting that night. She came and picked me up and took me to a meeting. And you know, the first meeting I went to that night was December the 5th of 1973. The meeting I went into, there was three old men and her and me, and that was the meeting. And I don't even know what was said. I was very, very sick. I was so sick I couldn't even stand up straight. I kept falling over. I had lost 30 pounds in 30 days. I was a dying woman alcoholic. And I went into that meeting, and the only thing that I came out with was that these men told me that I didn't have to be that way anymore if I didn't want to be. And for whatever reason, I didn't want to be that way anymore. I would have done anything to not be that way. Anything. And the next day, I went to work. I was so sick. I went, but I still had this job somehow. I don't know how I kept this job. I had been laying in bed, drunk, for 3 weeks, calling into the office, getting my messages. And so I knew if I didn't get into the job, I was going to be fired. So the next morning, I'm having DTs and hallucinating and everything else. I showered as best I could, walked into my office, walked into my boss's office, and I told him, I said, you know, I think I have a problem with alcohol, like it was big news to him. And I told him, I said, I met some people last night, and I think they're going to help me. And he says, you know, Lynn, it's a good thing you came in here today and told me that, because I was going to fire you when you came in. But if you're going to try and do something about your drinking, I'll stick with you a while and see what happens. And that day at noon, I went to another meeting, and I met some women there. And then that night, well, I got to tell you, that night, I wanted to go to a meeting. I mean, I just didn't know what I wanted. I was hallucinating. I was having DTs. I hallucinated She calls me the next night, Thursday night, and she says, do you think you can drive yourself to the meeting? I said, oh, yeah, I guess, I guess. I mean, I was so sick. I shouldn't have been driving anywhere. And so it turns out that she wanted me to go to this meeting she wanted to go to, which was a singles meeting. And she was going there looking to get laid that night, I guess. And she didn't want a newcomer in her car. So I drove myself to the meeting. And I never forget this meeting because it was, there weren't a lot of meetings in these days. And this meeting that I went to was like a young people's meeting of our time. And I walked in there and the two meeting people that were running the meeting weren't quite like these guys, but it was kind of that way. It was like these guys looked like they were from the Mickey Mouse Club. I mean, not that you guys, but they were so clean. They were all cleaned up, you know? This one girl, her name was Roxana, and she was blonde, and she looked so pretty. She looked like that Darlene on the Mouseketeers. And then the guy looked like Chip. I mean, he looked just like him. He had a nice little, I don't think he had a suit and tie, but he was clean. He wasn't the kind of people I was hanging around with. And I felt like, oh, God, I felt so inferior. But, you know, I wanted to be cleaner. I wanted to not be living the way I was living. And anyway, that weekend, I met some people that introduced me to the first three steps of the program. And, you know, it really was the turning point for me. I was as big a pill head as I was an alcoholic. And it wasn't until that Saturday, 4 days after my first meeting, that I was introduced to the first three steps of the program. And essentially what they told me was this, that some of us, where that word says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that some of us put a lot of other things in there. We're powerless over the drugs, we're powerless over the food, we're powerless over the coke, we're powerless over the whatever. For me, that's it. It made sense. I was all of those things. And then she talked to me about the second step, and like many people who come to AA, I was kind of clueless. I didn't know if there was a God or not. I'd been through the whole thing, and I just was finally clueless. I was willing to believe whatever it was you guys were believing, because you looked clean. You looked like you were sober. You looked like you'd found a way out. And so I was willing. That's all I could tell you about the second step. But the third step is the one that was like putting the key in the lock and opening the door. Because when they told me the third step, she said to me, this girl said, that if you can make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of a higher power, even if you don't understand them, you will never again have to use a chemical to solve your living problems. And for me, that was the key that opened the door to Alcoholics Anonymous. Today, I'm still an addict, as much as I ever was, but my addiction is to God. When things are tough, I turn to God. When things are tough and I can't find God, I turn to a meeting. I use Alcoholics Anonymous and my higher power the way I used everything else before I got here. And I got to tell you, it's been wonderful. I've had a life beyond my wildest dreams. And, you know, when I want to just close with this. I think sobriety is really tough. My life hasn't gotten better, but I've gotten better. I've gotten better because of the 12 steps. They've transformed me into a person today that I can live with and that I can like and that I can be happy with. And I know beyond any shadow of a doubt that my Creator, my higher power, is using me today in the way my life was intended to be used. And I'm grateful for that. Thank you.